Hello, and welcome to a special episode of the Batteries Included podcast. I'm Dominic Ioni, and my co-host today is Tom Malogny, senior editor at Inside EVs and host of the YouTube channel State of Charge. For this episode, we are joined by a special guest, Forrest North, co-founder and CEO, or CTO, sorry, of, you just got a raise or a promotion there, sorry, CTO of Tello Trucks. So thank you very much for joining us, Forrest.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be on.
All right. So,
and it's been a long time. We when did we speak last? 2008?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So I was just saying before we started that I spoke to Forrest in like 2008 when he was starting up. He was still in stealth mode of Mission Motors. And we'll get into that just a little bit here in his intro. But yeah, it's been a while. But it was a great conversation. I still remember like pacing around the place where I lived at the time. And I was all excited. I hadn't really spoken to anybody like that. It was one of my first like telephone interview things. right. So. Thank you for joining us, and we're looking more to learning more about this mini-sized pickup truck with a big truck utility. But first, I wanted to talk about you and your background just for a moment. So you have a long and very interesting resume. So you were at Tesla back in the original Tesla Roadster days and worked on the battery packs before production, which were, you know, those battery packs were huge in ushering in this whole EV lithium age. And so that's a really important start. Then you founded Mission Motors, an electric motorcycle company. And that's interesting because electric motorcycles have this challenge of, packaging, all this powertrain and batteries in the smallest, possible space. So this is kind of a great background for you for this current project, I think. So anyway, after that, you founded Zatori, which launched PlugShare, the app a lot of us use today to help us find available chargers. It's great. I used it myself just recently, did some cross-country driving, and it really came in handy. So thank you for that. you were a VP of engineering for a while at FreeWire Technologies, and that company made DC chargers with integrated batteries. So again, with the batteries. And then finally, in 2018, you started a company called Neptune Scooters and engineered a dual motor stand-up scooter along with a docking system where they could be picked up and returned for like urban landscapes. So I'm not sure how, but I felt like this effort kind of led to starting Tello Trucks with Jason Marks, who is the CEO now at Tello. So I guess let's start here. How did Tello Trucks get started?
Yeah, well, thank you for the background. Basically, like when we were speaking originally at Mission Motors, because of Mission Motors, I've gotten a lot of people have approached me over the years who are interested in starting an electric motorcycle company or some variation of, and that's actually how I met Jason. So it was at the tail end of Neptune Scooters. The market for scooters was kind of collapsing at that point. And even though I think we had a really cool solution, and I still, fingers crossed, hope that I can do something with it someday, we were looking to contract out because we had a great team. And so a mutual friend introduced Jason and I, and he wanted to make an electric motorcycle. So we built it with him and the Neptune team. And then he had this idea of doing a motorcycle first. It was a retro futuristic a board track racer. So kind of modeled after the Indian motorcycle of 1912. As we kind of picked the same colors and a little bit of the same shape. So we made that, and he had this slide that he would show people that had a motorcycle, then a small car, then a small pickup truck. And we would show that to people, and every person we showed that to was like, "Ooh, this is a great progression, but I want the mini truck. I want that truck now." And it just kept happening over and over and over. And it actually turned out, and Jason maybe tells the story a little better than I do, but I think it was a Friday where an investor had said they were interested. We had to talk in the afternoon, and I was like, everyone keeps wanting the mini truck. Like, we've got to pivot. And he's like, okay. So he went out and interviewed 200 people over the weekend in both San Francisco and LA, and 89% of them wanted the mini truck, even motorcycle riders that he was going to like motorcycle meetups, because he really wanted to keep going with the motorcycles. We made it. It was done, and Monday we called those investors back and said, we're pivoting. just wanted to let you know they were still interested. We resubmitted all of our information and they invested by Thursday. And so we were off to the races. Like, we really pivoted and moved quickly. So it was the motorcycle background is how we met. And obviously I'd been in the EV space for a long time with PlugShare and everything else, as you guys have as well. Plug in America was a major factor in making EVs happen. So anyways, that was how we got started.
Wow. That's pretty cool. And I think that's a great pivot, because as much as I'm like a fan of electric motorcycles, man, it's a really tough sell right now until, like, you know, battery densities can allow for like 300 mile ranges instead of what, 150 now, maybe, at highway speeds.
Yeah. I would say for me, you know, I felt like I was starting to hit my head against the same wall that I'd hit my head against with Mission Motors. You know, there's some first principles that kind of, you know, you're fighting, which is aerodynamic drag is your biggest, you know, use of energy. And on a motorcycles have the worst aerodynamics, of any of the vehicles out there. So to, you know, a Prius has a better aerodynamic footprint than a motorcycle. So, you know, it's just really difficult to get, the range that people expect. So maybe you'd need a you know, 30% of a battery pack of a Tesla or something to go a similar range, and it would that would still be really a huge pack for a motorcycle. Also, there just aren't, the motorcycle market in the U.S. is I think the market cap is like 10 billion, which is already, it sounds like a lot, but that's too low for most VCs to be interested in. And 9 billion of that is Harley. So that just, you know, it's just, whatever, you know, the numbers might be slightly off, but it's the majority is that Harley group, which tend to think they want to go a lot farther than they actually go. So you're also fighting this range thing where 150 miles of range sounds like way too short for a motorcycle. But if you've ever ridden a motorcycle 150 miles, that's a pretty long day, especially on a sport bike or a not a comfortable cruiser.
Right. Right on. All right. So I guess let's talk about this truck a little bit then. We know it's small. So, you know, what? Maybe give us an idea of the size and what kind of utility you think you can endow with these small proportions.
Yeah, I mean, our approach is that we are both in this, you know, in the Bay Area. My co-founder Jason lives in San Francisco, as does Eve Bahar, other co-founder, and space is obviously a premium, and it's very difficult to find parking when you have a 20-foot long truck. But it's very easy if you have a Mini Cooper. There's just tons of spaces that are available. Even with the Mini Cooper having gotten larger over the years. So we're 152 inches long, which is the size of a two-door Mini Cooper nowadays. Now that has grown considerably since the original Mini Cooper, as you may know, but it's still a very small, a compact vehicle. So we wanted to pack as much capability into this compact shape as we could. So we did some early kind of figuring, and what we found is that if we moved the wheels, you know, farther forward, we could get a battery pack that was 100 kilowatt hours, which in my mind is really the what you need to be a vehicle that's useful in America, because of just the ranges that people drive occasionally, right? Like, they don't drive it every day, but occasionally you've got to do that drive for it to be a vehicle that you want, especially if you want it to be an adventure vehicle. And we, living in the city, you know, there's mass transportation. You can get around by bicycle. You can do lots of things to help the environment, but for sanity, you still need to get out of the city. You still need to go to the mountains, the beach. And we wanted to be able to support all that with the truck. So that was why we wanted to have that 100 kilowatt hour pack, or more. And we wanted to have four-wheel drive. We interviewed people. We heard from a lot of people, you know, they wanted a vehicle they could take into the snow, that they could park into the city, that they could take off-road, in that, you know, every that instance you need to do it. And here in California, those instances do come up, you know, not all the time, but they definitely come up, and you want to have that capability. So when we put all the components together, I mean, we could offer a 500 horsepower four-wheel drive, you know, 350 mile range truck with a 5-foot bed, which is pretty much what most trucks have nowadays. And then the things that we added to that was really, we love the mid gate design. We're not the first truck to implement that, but the mid-gate really allows you to put long items securely in your truck. So a big part of being in the city is safety of your stuff and not getting broken into, which is obviously a problem in San Francisco. But if you have a tonneau cover and you have a mid-gate, you can put longer items in and have it be, you know, relatively safe. You can stop at a cafe and no one's going to just pull it out of the back of your truck. So that was, those are all of the kind of design considerations that went into what we, how we built this, designed and built this truck.
And I understand that, like, just as far as a utilities thing, one of the things, standard measurements or metrics, I mean, we've traditionally had with pickup trucks is, will it fit a 4x8 piece of plywood? And with the mid-gate, yours can do that, right?
Yes. So we can fit, I think, several 4x8 sheets of plywood with the mid-gate down. So if you're, the idea there was, you wouldn't necessarily store 10 stacks of plywood with the mid-gate down. If you're moving like a bunch of plywood, you're going to put the tailgate down and you're just going to move a bunch of plywood, right? I mean, or drywall or whatever. And that's what most trucks out there typically do. If you go to Home Depot, you see a bunch of pickup trucks with they don't even put the mid-gate or the tailgate down. It's just sticking out the back, right? All the weight of that plywood is just resting on those poor latches on the side of their tailgate. Tailgate's doing a lot of work. So you can still do that. But we were kind of thinking of the cultural creatives, the people that are doing projects, moving arts, maybe it's surfboards, maybe it's whatever. And it kind of happens that you're going through the city, you want to stop and get some coffee or whatever, and you just want to have your stuff not messed with. And so that mid-gate really helps you. You could have a 4x8 sheet if you're doing that, or a 4x8 piece of foam core or whatever it is, you know, and you could have it be safe for a few minutes while you went in and did something.
Nice. Cool. I put up a little picture up here on the front so that our audience or on YouTube can see what we're talking about at least.
Absolutely. And then one of the other things that we thought would be fun is, and we got a lot of, whenever we talked about the truck, people had a fond memory of the Brat. You know, with the seats facing backwards and being able to sit in the bed. So we have we call it the Monster Tunnel, this tunnel that goes underneath the bed. It's the Monster Tunnel because it's under the bed. And we made a hatch on top of that so that when you remove that hatch, it could actually be the footwell to be able to put another seat in the bed and have kind of like a safari, you know, kind of up high seating, maybe when you are looking at wildlife or taking the kids on an adventure or something.
Oh, that's an idea. So possibly for a third row somehow?
Yeah.
That wouldn't be that wouldn't really, would that pass FMVSS?
So yeah, we have looked into that. I don't have this. So you actually can get away with some different things in the back. There are some FM, I don't know. Jason knows the numbers more specifically, but I think it's 208, but, you have to have a side impact, window when you're in the back, but there's an exception for, vehicles. So for example, the Jeeps and the Broncos and the others, they have these seats and they pass those rules. So it's a similar rule.
Gotcha.
I'm looking to see if I have a picture of it. I think it's on our website. Similar place to where you got the last photo. I think we have some pictures out there.
Okay.
Yeah. So Forrest, love the concept.
Hi Tom.
How are you? A friend of mine has a, you mentioned Subaru Brat. What I think of is Honda Acty. One of my good friends imported one of those recently, and we drive around in it a lot. It's a really, you know, small little pickup truck and right-hand drive. But I actually thought about importing one and converting it to electric. I still haven't completely ruled that out. But if you make this, I wouldn't have to do that because it's basically the same thing except nice, new, and modern. But
we are making it, so you should put your pre-order in now.
Right. Well, that's what I was going to ask about. You know, you've been involved in startups. You know, some have made it, some haven't. I've been covering this scene for a long time now. I've seen a lot of cool things come along and say, "Wow, I can't wait till that comes out." and then it just never comes out. We've seen so many cool concepts that I have to admit, tainted by past failures of all these other companies. And, you know, if I would have, you know, put my life savings on this coming to fruition, I'd have to bet against you. I hate to say it. You know, what is going to make Tello Trucks be one of the companies that actually gets there? Now, I know you've got a lot of great people, but some of these other companies have had great experienced people from other brands. And I was like, well, if he's involved in this project, I'm sure it's going to be well. And then it fails. I don't want to get set up again, because this is a cool concept. I'd love to tool around one of these. And honestly, if you do make this, I will buy one. I'm telling you flat out right now, I will buy one. But sell me on why this is going to actually make it. You're not just going to be another one of those startups that end up in the dustbin of history.
Yeah, well, first of all, I would say I'm not sure which companies you're talking about. There's definitely some out there. And we look at a lot of them, and we talk to as many people as we can that were involved, and try to figure out what went wrong. And a lot of them, you know, they all have different stories, right? So some of them raised too much money too fast, and then got on kind of a trajectory where they were burning huge amounts of capital because they were required to, essentially. You know, if investors put in, you know, $1 billion into a startup that can't handle it, that startup basically acts like a larger company. They just start making pyramids, you know, of managers and you know, and that doesn't necessarily go well. They also make decisions that you can see if you go through Detroit like we've toured facilities that have manufactured parts for most of the companies that have failed that you're talking about. And they can just point to things like, this company paid $100 million for these steel tooling, and they've only made a few thousand vehicles. They could have spent $1 million on Kirksite tooling, which is a soft, like a very soft metal that they make tooling from that only lasts for maybe 5,000 parts. Right. But that when you are tasked with not going with crawl, walk, run, you're just going right to sprint. You make those decisions, and then they come back to bite you when the market doesn't like your product. And then you have to ask, well, what was the product? Were you just trying to be, you know, a few percent better than Tesla in some ways, or a few percent better than this vehicle, or what was the niche you're really going after? So when we thought about this, we were, you know, I as a startup founder and entrepreneur, I like to go for blue ocean, you know, kind of ideas where there isn't a lot of competitors. And what we saw was that the most popular truck for like 20 years as a category was small trucks in the 90s, you know, late 80s, 90s, early 2000s. And those trucks are still around because they're so useful. Like you go around the area here in the Bay Area, and not just in San Francisco, but the peninsula, which suburban, it's not like as compact as the city, but there's a high premium on your garage space. And so garages don't have cars in them here for the most part. And it pushes the vehicles out on the street, and the vehicles, you know, all the vehicles on the street, like, it is, if they're smaller, they're better. And so people buy these older Toyota SR5s, Ford Rangers. They're paying $5,000 above what the MSRP on that car was originally, you know, 15, 20 years ago, because they're hard to find. And people are just putting tons of miles on them. All the landscapers, we are next to a paint distributor. They've got 5 old Ford Rangers because they fit between their front of their business and the sidewalk. And if they were any bigger, they'd be over the sidewalk and maybe they get a ticket, or maybe they annoyed the neighbors. So we were looking at this as like, there's this blue ocean of a form factor, and EV can totally be whatever form factor you want. Why are these other EV trucks trying to compete with the 20-foot long truck market? Like, there's all these problems when you scale up and get that big. You've got to make chassis bigger and heavier, which means you've got to have more battery, which more battery tends to raise the height of the vehicle. So now you've got more aerodynamic drag. So it just like piles up, and now you're at, you know, over 200 kilowatt hours to go 300 miles. And now it's like, okay, well, now you're about as efficient as an efficient gas car. are you really going to save? Are you really helping the climate issue, or are you really even solving a need that you have? So when I look at it, I feel like we're going to exist because when we talk to people and we show people this truck, people are first of all blown away, because when you're next to it, it doesn't feel like a very small truck. It actually feels like a pretty substantial, vehicle. But then when you can maneuver it around, it's so zippy and it's so fast and it's so easy to park. It's just a really capable vehicle. I think people are going to love it. And we're hell bent on getting this thing produced. So you will get one, Tom.
Okay. Well, I'll maybe put the deposit down. because I can see myself tooling around with this. So let's say I do, let's say after this podcast, I go to your website and I drop my money on deposit. When can I reasonably expect?
We believe that we can start deliveries in 2026. So early 2026. So this 2025 is going to be all about homologation, ramping up contract manufacturing. Homologation, as you know, is passing all the rules that allow you to sell a vehicle. That's another, coming back to your point of how vehicles have fallen down. There's a pickup truck that's failed recently that, from what we heard, made hundreds of prototypes, each different than the other, before even attempting to go through homologation. You cannot sell a vehicle until you've gone through homologation. Like, homologation is our number one goal milestone for this next year.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredibly difficult bringing a new vehicle to market. You went through that with Tesla. This is a different game than motorcycles. You know, it's automobile is so much harder to bring to fruition. I think, yep. You know, what was the story early on that the, Everhart told Musk $50 million and we'll get the vehicle to production or something like that. And then Elon was like, you know, $120 million in, and there was no end in sight, you know, so. And that was 20 years ago. You know, it took almost $200 million, right? I think just under $200 million to bring the Roadster, somewhere like that. And that's 20 years ago. What do you think? How much money are you going to need to bring something like this to market?
That's a good question. We do have all that in our decks and stuff for investors. I don't have it off the top of my head, but that number is pretty well known. So one of the things that we have that's really a great a superpower is that Andy Palmer, who was the ex COO of at Nissan, and he's really the godfather of the Nissan Leaf. He pushed that through internally, you know, and has all sorts of war stories about that. Then was the CEO at Aston Martin, stood mm-hmm. up different factories to build different lines. So one ended up was like $300 million. The next one they built, with some better learnings, was $250 million. So we have some pretty good industry numbers on what it takes to set up a new line in a fairly budget way. Like Aston Martin, you might think of as like a fairly, I mean, it's obviously a luxury item. It's a storied brand, but it didn't have like a, you know, unlimited amount of cash like some startups that raised in this last financial cycle had, right? So they're pretty pragmatic. So we get great advice from him and his network. So we do, and then contract manufacturing has come a long way as well. So when I was at Tesla working on the Roadster, the relationship with Lotus, you know, was tricky. And there were certainly some delays and problems that came out of that. But since then, I think that there's, frankly, they needed Lotus to be able to raise the money they did, because Lotus gave them the credibility and everything. But it was, as an engineer at the time, it was crazy. We had parts being made in Thailand, China, Taiwan, California, all getting shipped for final assembly in the UK. And we had battery packs that were like on ships for like more than 30 days showing up that were dead because they had too big of a parasitic draw. So, I mean, there were just all sorts of nightmares around that. So we're not going to try to replicate that. But right now in the US, manufacturing capacity is, I think I read an article recently, is in the 50% kind of range. Like there's a lot of overcapacity in a lot of the automotive contract manufacturing world. So we have talked to a number of contract manufacturers that are excited to take us on. And so we're kind of weighing that against, factory creation, which both of them have a big list of pros and cons.
Yeah, well, if you went your route of making your own factory creation, you're talking a couple. You got to add a couple of years onto production.
So, yeah. Okay. So our goal is to be profitable at 5,000 units a year, which we believe we can be from all of our discussions as we talked with the network of previous founders of companies. There are a lot of contract manufacturers that can take you up to about 10,000 parts a year, and then after that, it starts to be in the realm of like either at a really major tier one contract manufacturer, Magna Steyr or whatever, or you're building your own factory. And it kind of depends on the incentive structure that the government has at that time, which is obviously a big question mark in the air right now. I don't really have anything to speak to that, so I don't necessarily want to take up a lot of time on that. But maybe you guys
it's a question.
It's just a question.
Yeah, I don't even think it's a question at this point. I think we know what's going to happen.
Yeah. Contract manufacturing sounds like a great solution for you guys because, like Tom's saying, build your own factory. That's going to be like at least 2 years, I think, down the road before you even think about shipping anything. So this is great. And I guess I didn't realize there was that much capacity in the U.S. I'm only really aware of Magna over here, and I don't even know if they do any production here. I know there's Valmet there used to be Valmet. I'm not even sure if they're still around.
Just some off the top of my head. I mean, there's Roush, Edison, Schwab, Foxconn, VinFast, Magna Steyr. There's quite a few contract manufacturers.
Okay. So just to get back to the truck a little bit, I just want to hear more about this. So this is a pretty incredible powertrain that you have in this. So can you tell us a little bit about this? Like the power, what kind of performance or range around the things around that area?
Yeah, we're trying to use as much off the shelf as we can. So we're trying not to reinvent the wheel. We're not basing our, this is, I think, another mistake that other vehicles have made is really trying to compete. Because it worked for one company to have an amazing 0-60, a lot of others are like, okay, I have a bigger, really sort of go down this route of 0-60 numbers. So we were like, this is a pickup truck. We're not going to worry about that. It's going to be great, but we're going to make this thing compact, affordable, and really capable. But as it turns out, we can fit a 250 horsepower motor in the front and in the back. It's a 4,400 pound vehicle. With the payload, it crosses over the 6,000 pound GVWR threshold, which is very useful for tax structure for commercial entities. But it's still, it's quite a light vehicle for 500 horsepower. So it's going to be snappy.
Yeah. That's kind of crazy, actually. And I guess you can offer in a two-wheel drive and two-wheel drive, single motor and dual motor. So single, right.
Yes.
Is the single motor rear wheel or front wheel drive?
That is a debate right now. There's an interesting thing in the truck world where people feel like they like the rear wheel drive because they think if it's light, they want to have a little bit heavier in the back to put traction on the wheels. That's just a common thing I hear. I don't think it's necessarily accurate from a physics perspective on an electric vehicle because the weight's pretty evenly distributed when you're unloaded. And I personally think a front wheel drive single motor truck would be awesome. So we'll see. That hasn't been announced yet. what would you guys want?
Put me in the rear wheel drive department. Yeah. Okay. Because when you take off, the weight of the vehicle shifts to the back, so that's where the more traction is at the on acceleration. It might not get as great as regen power on deceleration, but that's the trade off. But you get better steering that way too in town. If it's a small vehicle, you want to have great maneuverability as well, right? So in my mind, that's how it all kind of works. But
yeah,
I understand a lot of people are very pro front wheel drive.
I grew up in Washington State as my co-founder, where it's very wet, and so having having front wheel drive is very nice for cornering and slippery conditions.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We'll have to take a survey.
So I wanted to just talk about your timeline just a little bit. So you're looking at a 2020, early 2026 first deliveries. I mean, I hope that's doable. I will buy you a beer if you make that timeline. Let's see. But so what do you need to do to get reach that point? So already you've built you have an H point mock-up. So it's basically kind of as a hit point. So basically how people, fit within the structure. And you also have a styling book. So Yves Behar is your designer who actually did the first Mission One motorcycle too, I believe, right?
Yep. Yeah, that's right.
And you mentioned he's a co-founder as well, so that's kind of pretty cool. You got the band back together, kind of.
Yeah, and he brings so much. He has a company, Fuse Project, a design firm, and so they do a lot. They lift a lot on the marketing, on the branding, obviously on the design, website, so many things that it really allows us to focus on the engineering.
Right. So you have a nice styling book. It's kind of cool. People can check that out on your site. I think we had a picture of it up here earlier. And now you had a drivable prototype last year, I believe. But you have a new one that you just sent off. So you have a partnership with Aria, which is
Aria
local.
is our low volume contract manufacturer. They typically do, I think less than 500 vehicles a year kind of realm for their clients. But you could ask them that. So we can do some initial run with them. So we're making the first two, prototypes, gamma vehicles, but they are production intent. So that is one thing also that we learned, from all these vehicles, and something Mark Tarpanin is one of our investors and advisor. I was just on the phone with him in the last hour. Really just hammers. He's always saying, okay, you design this, is it production intent? Make it production intent. So, we really focus our efforts on homologation, production intent, rather than making a bunch of prototypes for marketing. It's pros and cons again, but we really feel like the market's there and we're just moving as fast as we can to get to production to serve it.
Right. Could you talk a little bit about safety? It's such a small vehicle and the cab is so far forward. It looks like your feet would be about 2 feet from the front edge of the vehicle. That could be wrong. It could be farther, but talk a little bit about why people shouldn't be concerned about safety. It looks like I said, with how close you're sitting up front.
Yeah. So my co-founder, Jason, his background has been mostly in safety. So he worked for National Instruments for 8 years, running a lot of the programs that all of the other automotive safety programs would interface with. So all the test equipment for the radar and LIDAR and ADAS systems. So we have been very focused on, we have a team that we use that helps us with crash testing the vehicle in LS Dyna. So we've run hundreds of simulations at this point, and so we're fairly confident that we have plenty of space to absorb energy before it enters the occupant zone. I think what people probably it'll take a while, I think, for people to get over. I mean, when you look at a truck with a giant hood, it feels like there's a lot of space between you and something that might happen. But if you actually go on YouTube and watch those crash tests of those trucks, you will see that only the part that's right in front of the wheel actually compresses. And then the whole truck just boinks. It just goes bonk. It's not a lot of crumple zone. And the reason being is that the trucks are built differently than sedans, and the motors are much bigger. So people tend to pay more for a bigger motor, which ends up being a larger metal box in front of you that's not compressible. And that in a truck ends up being hard mounted to the frame in such a way that it really doesn't get out of the way either. So the truck safety side is misunderstood, I think, probably by most people. So we are focused on safety, number one. That's our main concern. And we're doing a lot of interesting things that, you know, none of them super unique, but like putting them together so that anything that's non-compressible is moving out of the way, maximizing our crumple zone. We have more crumple zone than other vehicles that have passed homologation. So definitely going to be, you know, we're definitely going to pass homologation. We're definitely going to be a safe vehicle. We have some aims on some technology that has been proven but not utilized yet that we think can take us a step further in safety, so that we could be, you know, 5-star crash safety or above.
Okay, a couple quick questions. Charging J3400, I'm assuming. Do you have targets as far as DC fast charge speeds in the area? That's number one. Number two, how about vehicle to grid, vehicle to home, any offloading power capability?
Yeah, I mean, I started Zatorre to balance the grid with electric vehicles. So I'm a big proponent of vehicle to grid. And I understand all of there's a number of issues and things to overcome to make that, you know, like truly ubiquitous and successful. But that's certainly something that we think about and want to offer. Right now, we're focused on really the vehicle, making it the most useful. And so that is using the NACS charging standard. So we'll be NACS, not just compatible, but we are NACS native. So the plug on our vehicle will be a NACS plug. As you know, charging speed is essentially dictated by the battery. Our battery pack could handle over 350 kilowatts. There's no over 350 kilowatt chargers out there. So we're going to be charging at the fastest speeds available.
Okay.
Well, they're coming. Alpitronics is rolling out, what, 400 kilowatts? Altel's got a 620 kilowatt. They're not really rolling out big time yet, mm-hmm. but they do have it. So I know, and we know that, you know, better technology in China has advanced to the place where they have like 5C, 6C batteries that can charge in 10 minutes, but we need those, you know, 620 kilowatt charges for. Mm-hmm. I think that's coming, but 350 is impressive. I did want to talk just a bit more about the battery itself, because that's really, in my mind, that's kind of like your area of like special expertise. Yeah. And so I understand you're going with 2170 format cells. So yeah. Cylindrical?
Cylindrical, yeah. I'm a big proponent of cylindrical.
Right. And you've also said it's going to be like the most energy dense pack of any vehicle. And I assume that means like from China as well, because I mean, China's got cells 350 watt hours per kilogram. I think NIO is using it's a semi-solid state battery in a few NIO packs right now. That's just kind of starting out. So, and a lot of people have been saying recently that, you know, they don't like cylindrical. I can't say it now, but cells because of the spaces between. You can pack more energy with pouch cells. But so what's the key to the success of getting your pack so energy dense?
Yeah. So it is interesting what I found, and I made prismatic packs before. We've used prismatic packs, built pouch packs at Mission actually. And one of the things that happens with pouch packs that people don't take into account is that you end up losing a huge amount of space, with the compression of the pack. So you have to mechanically compress prismatics and pouch. You might think that you don't need to compact prismatics because they have their own case, but they still need some compression as well. So you end up using space for those mechanical things. And the cooling of pouch and prismatic is just physically challenging, because there's not great places to remove heat where you're not trying to remove heat through layers of plastic, which is not a great thermal conductor. So cylindrical cells have this amazing physical advantage, which is the magic of hoop stress. So we all experience that magic of hoop stress through Coca-Cola cans or any beverage can. If you ever have had a soda, which I'm assuming everyone has, that can is extremely thin. In fact, if you go to another country and pick up a can, they're always heavier. And people are like, why are they heavier in other countries? It's because there's actually IP protecting how thin those cans can be in the US from a material standpoint. So so basically such a thin amount of material in a hoop, it just really can contain pressure so well. So a cylindrical cell can just absolutely control the pressure of the cell and it is absolutely stable. It's also And I don't think this gets said nearly enough. It's also the most recyclable and reusable. So I just was talking to a battery recycler recently, and they were saying, it doesn't matter the size of your prismatic cell. You could get this big prismatic cell. The market will pay you 10 cents for it once it's end of life. 2170, 80 cents for that 2170, which is, you know, a fraction of the capacity of a bigger prismatic cell. So that's a really huge incentive when you're talking about total cost of ownership for and you're just talking about full life cycle, you know, from an environmental perspective, from a total cost of ownership perspective, from a manufacturing perspective, there's just so many benefits to these 2170s. Also, because it's this form factor that's very ubiquitous, all of the technology, the best technology goes into it the soonest. Even in the process of making the cells, it's better. It's I don't know if you've seen pouch cells or prismatic cells, but they off gas in those pouch cells. And a lot of times those pouches then get removed and another pouch gets put on. So there's like waste that's happening even before you get the battery. And then the thing that breaks down over time, and it's just, I mean, it's just obvious. I'm surprised that pouch cells have come this far, frankly, is that you're trying to seal the longevity of the pouch is really about the seal around the tab. And so you've got a square thing that you're trying to seal to. It is always harder to seal something to a square than it is to a circle. And they just run into, they basically, that's where they leak, is around those tabs. Once that seal is gone, that battery is gone. And your battery pack is always dictated by the weakest cell, you know? So it's like the weakest link in the chain is what breaks or what restricts your whole battery. The other thing that's interesting, I think, well, you know, from the cylindrical versus prismatic or pouch cell realm is that the traditional automotives went towards the pouch and prismatic cells because there were fewer parts, and they come from a culture of fewer parts means more reliable. But in a battery, it's actually the opposite. The smaller your unit is, the more you can sacrifice one unit without doing anything to the whole. And the easier it is to contain a thermal event if the unit is smaller than larger. If you have a pack that holds 80 cells and one cell goes out, that's a big deal. But if you have 5,960 cells, it's not such a big deal.
So what's the magic that allowed you to get such the density down besides beyond just it being a cylindrical? I believe you work with Samsung. Like extra high gravimetric density or something?
We're using the 50S right now, which is a really, you know, from an energy cell perspective, it has a really large power capacity as well. Like you can draw, I think 45 amps, right? So it's you know, kind of in between an energy cell and a power cell. We're talking to companies that you know, are going to have a 7 amp hour cell, you know, soon. Right now we're working with 5 amp hour cells. So that the industry is still progressing, right? Like those 7 amp hour cells will probably be 2-3 years out. But we can see on the horizon, you know, cells continuing to gain in capacity. So it's a great cell. It has a great capacity, certainly. And it's very reliable and it's very well known. So one of the things that we do is really focus on the Z height of the pack. So making sure that all of the cooling, all the connections, all the safety and balancing, everything happens within the smallest, you know, a Z height, because that Z height, which means basically like above the ground, if you're just to lay the pack on the ground, like the height above the ground, you put that in the bottom of your car, anything, any thickness directly translates into moving the seat up higher and moving the person's head up higher and moving the roof up higher. And that increases aerodynamic drag. So really focused on keeping aerodynamic drag low by keeping that battery pack thin. So it's very thin. We pack the cells very close together, but we have active and passive cooling that is really effective at cooling them such that we're not worried about a thermal event causing thermal runaway and propagating. So if you have one cell that goes into thermal runaway, the goal is you really want to, first of all, obviously the goal is to keep them from going to thermal runaway. That happens through active management. That happens through fusing every cell, which is something that we do. Something that there's another giant company that does, but a lot of companies don't. And I feel like that's a very effective safety measure So that was something that we needed to make sure that we could do from the start, which we do. So fusing every cell, cooling every cell, and really thermally linking those cells together so that you have a large thermal mass that's with a high conductivity, high thermal conductivity, so that any cell that starts to heat up can stay the same, essentially the same temperature as the cells around it.
So you're pretty confident that you could go through multiple fast charging sessions, like on a road trip, you know, hauling it, hit the charge station, you know, hook up for 20 minutes, get going. So you can do that a bunch of times in a row without it derating?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Oh, sweet. Okay. Because that's like a fail point or failing of some other companies out there I won't mention right now. And it seems like that's kind of like really at the core of, you know, the battery is, I mean, a battery is like the heart and soul of an electric vehicle, right? Basically. Yeah. And so it's just odd to me that, you know, you'd stumble on that part of it anyway.
Yeah. I mean, part of it is just being in this industry for so long, right? Like we've seen you see all these different things, you see how people have done it over time, you know, what works and what doesn't work and what can be improved. And it's really about the holistic package. Like what are all the things that come together to make a really great pack for the use case of the product? So for example, we were able to move a lot of that thermal active cooling instead of putting it between the cells, and instead of putting a lot of it under the cells, we have a very thin amount that's under the cells, nothing in between the cells. And we put most of the active cooling mechanism on the side of the pack, so that we get this extra buffer zone to the side of the vehicle, so that we have, you know, for penetration of outside objects into the vehicle, we get the maximum amount of space before anything would touch those cells.
And Forrest, okay. What about sales and service? How do we buy it? How do we get it fixed?
Yeah, we're still working on that, but we plan to be kind of a hybrid. So we've talked to a bunch of people in the industry. Should you have dealerships? Should you work with other franchise dealerships? Should you go direct to consumer? And everyone they've been talking to has basically said you have to do all of it. So we're probably starting out direct to consumer. You buy it on our website, we deliver it to you. There's some good services that can deliver those vehicles. But you need to work. You need to have relationships with service centers that can bring them in and provide service if it's needed. Obviously the number one goal is to not have any service needed. I'm driving a Nissan Leaf from 2011 still. And I have had it serviced once in that time, once for them to replace the battery pack for free, which they did. So I don't count that. No money off of my back. That was their poor design. And then the second time is I changed the tires and the rotors at like 80,000 miles, which was just a few, like this year, I'm at like 90,000 miles on this vehicle. So you can make an electric vehicle that is reliable.
you change the brakes,
right? Service.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had Ford mobile service in my driveway today because there was a recall on my Lightning a service bulletin. So, and they came, Ford's offering that new service now, I guess they're jumping on because they see other startups are offering it and people like it. So they performed the service in my driveway. So that's probably going to be part of your service plan. I just was curious if there'd actually be like regional service centers where vehicles that you couldn't fix on site need to be taken to.
Definitely. I mean, we have had some early conversations with dealership groups that would also help on the commercial side, that have commercial fleets. There's definitely some capacity out there of dealership groups that would like to do that. I have talked to other CEOs who have, made physical products and had recalls, and they basically have said, if you're making a product, you're probably gonna have a recall at some point in its life. You have to prepare for that.
Mm-hmm. Right. Are you planning like a 50 state strategy to start off with, or are you going to focus on say California or other ZEV states?
That's a good question. I can say that from our pre-orders, you know, it's really, if you just look at the top 10 cities in the US, that's where the pre-orders are. So yeah, I think some of the surprise to us was that we got a lot of pre-orders from Dallas. We really didn't think we were going to be like breaking into Texas. We want to serve people where they're at, and we're going to deliver to those to where the pre-orders are. Yeah.
So speaking of pre-orders, I believe you just yesterday or recently you put up a configuration now on your site for the, for a Telos. So people are interested in the, and it's called the MT1, I guess, is the model name for this.
Yes, and that was somewhat by accident, but sure.
Oh, was it? Well, I mean, you can always change it.
On our Discord channel, and then everyone started calling that, and then so we were like, all right, that's
okay. Yeah. I don't know. I'm not sure how I feel about, like, I kind of prefer like names, like rather than alphanumeric situations, but you know, I don't know what you.
That may change. I mean, what I'm saying is that didn't come from our chief creative officer.
Gotcha. So we're looking at prices so you have two different battery sizes. What are the sizes of the batteries?
I think it's 76 kilowatts or something, and 106 are the two capacities. Right. So in the kind of 260-mile range and 350-mile range, we believe it'll be over both of those, but we haven't until we have the vehicle in testing. That's our estimation.
So, what's going to be available for the first, I don't know, 6 months to a year? Are you going to offer all of these variations in the first? Because it seems like it would be more expensive to have that sort of, you know, the manufacturing of it would be more complicated, and just it feels like it would be just cheaper to have one configuration going down the line for a period of time. So what are you starting off with?
That's a good question. You know, typically vehicle companies that we've seen in this space have started with the most, luxurious models first. In some ways it makes sense, because you know then that all of the extras that you are offering, you know how to put together onto a vehicle. So in some ways that makes sense. I think a lot of it will be like what people decide, what they configure in the pre-orders. So, I mean, we have an active, community of people discussing the vehicle on Discord. We look at how people are going to configure it, and I think it will probably start with the more popular model first.
Okay.
But that being said, I would say that the different battery pack, the same number of cells, is just different. It's just different spec cells, which is how most of the other vehicle companies do that as well. I don't know if people realize that. I think people think that the smaller pack might be like a less number of cells, but it's essentially the same weight, same number of cells. And the reason vehicle companies do that is because if you change the number of cells, you'd have to retest the vehicle through homologation.
Right. Yeah. Right. Okay. So it's the same number of cells. It's just bigger buffers. Is that what
it's just the same process? No, it's just that, I mean, if you go online right now, you can get a 2170, that's a 4 amp hour cell, or you can get one that's a, 5.5 amp hour cell.
Okay. And they're so different cells,
costs, but they're the same form factor. They're the same weight. The chemistry has been set up slightly differently. Typically the lower capacity cells are more stable. They've just been being produced for longer, and they probably last longer as well.
All right. So I guess we're looking at hit this real quick. So pricing, and we're looking at $46,019 for your dual motor, 500 horsepower dual, but with the, and then throw the extra $3,980 on it if you want the big battery.
Yeah.
On top of that. So we're looking at about $50,000-ish, I guess.
Right. Is, and then down below our reservation fee, you can see there's a number that includes the $7,500 tax credit, which may be a federal thing, maybe a state thing. Maybe not be there at all.
Right. So. Yeah, I believe on our Friday show, we mentioned something about California maybe replacing, if the federal incentive goes away, reinstating their former incentive program.
Yeah. State level. Which I hope they do. I mean, first of all, I hope the federal government continues to incentivize EVs. I mean, we're kind of like, on the adoption curve, it's still growing, and there's typically a bit of a lag, like right around now on an S curve of technology adoption, where you're kind of crossing over from that early adopter crowd, to the mainstream. It feels like it's crossed over to me, but it also kind of feels like there's a bit of a pause in the zeitgeist, I guess.
right. It's for all of us. We've been all of three of us here have been in the EV scene for, you know, since the 2000s, and so yeah,
seems like a long time.
yeah. Thinking back, I didn't realize it was going to take this long, and now I feel like it's still taking longer than I really want it to, but I'm just waiting for that tipping point any day now. So just to hit this real quick, if people do want to pre-order, it's $152. What assurances?
Dollar for every inch.
Right. It's 152 inches long vehicle, $152 deposit. And they're fully refundable?
Yes, they're fully refundable at any time. We don't use that money for anything. It's in an escrow account. I think there's legal things around that. So people ask us all the time, why don't you take more and you could use that to fund the company? Like that's not how it works.
Right.
Yeah.
You mentioned you have other investors. So you've already done, I guess, your initial round or two.
Yeah. We've done our pre-seed and our seed. We'll be raising Series A early next year. So we've accomplished a lot with very little. And I think that's so far been what's been most impressive to the investors that we've spoken to. And a lot of that is really just about doing the, you know, crawling, walking, running, like just doing what you need to do at the right time, leveraging all the things that exist that have come before. So we're not reinventing the wheel. We're not reinventing powertrain. We're really focused on the two areas that we can differentiate around, which is battery pack design, which we're good at, and safety. And that those two things are what allow us to get this form factor, which kind of doesn't exist right now.
So you're using off-the-shelf motors then? You're not doing the motor technology yourself?
We are, yeah. So and
same with the inverters?
Yes. And they're built as one package. So it's like already a unit in production.
So you have a supplier already lined up?
Yes. For these first prototypes, I mean, we don't have a full-on manufacturing agreement yet, so I don't know if I want to announce that. Sure. But there's a lot of things you can get off the shelf, and then at some point you need to, you know, have a bigger agreement with that company.
Right. Well, I look forward to hearing. I have some suspicions of who that might be actually, but I'll just keep that to myself right now. Let's see. Anything else, Tom? We should hit. We've gone a lot longer than I really expected.
Yeah, you know, we're up against
it now. There's so
much
to talk about. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, why don't we aim to have Forrest back on in about 6 months for a progress update? Maybe
that'd be great.
You know, late spring, early summer, 2025, and see where we're at.
Absolutely, and then you guys can maybe come and do a test drive.
I'd be all down for that. Definitely.
And one thing I would say, if you're like Tom and you felt like you've been burnt by other EVs not existing, this pre-order that's fully refundable and will, you know, isn't going to go away. It's the thing that we then take and show, investors, hey, we have this many pre-orders. These are the people that are interested. So if you want to make it happen, you could help us by pre-ordering and basically you're raising your hand saying that this is a thing that you want. We try to make it as low risk as possible for you. You could always get a refund, later down the road. So that's one of the things that could really help us make it happen.
And I feel like those are, it's also a good way to get people to like, not only like financially invest in the company, but also emotionally invest in the company. You know, the people are looking at that. If they have like a, you know, if you $100 or $150 in it, it's kind of, it's on their mind. It'll be on their mind more often. And you have you said you have a Discord channel.
Yeah.
People can keep up with you. Right. And actually, if people are interested in more things that we haven't talked about here, you do have as well a YouTube channel. And there's like a ton of different videos on this that, you know, covered various aspects, engineering design. I think there's one about suspension, probably something about aerodynamics and safety. All that
and
stuff,
then,
all that good stuff.
We've just started recently something called Tele Talks, where like one of the first ones up there was me interviewing Andy Palmer. And we just have so many, you know, great conversations with really interesting people in the industry that I just kind of thought it'd be fun to just like what you guys are doing, just kind of record them for if other people are interested. They're interesting to me, so I wasn't sure if it'd be interesting to other people, but they're not necessarily about the truck. They're kind of about, you know, like the one with Andy is really about his history and everything.
Oh, cool. So I subscribe to the channel and hope that maybe you'll have Mark Tarpanin on, because I don't really know much about him, except he's been there all along in the background, you know, making out like a bandit. And I imagine he's a pretty smart dude. So I'd kind of like to hear from him at some point. But
and he's been an advisor to all of my startups. He's a really great advisor as well. So it's been it's a pleasure to have him on board this endeavor.
Right on. All right. So I guess we can wrap it up, so people can keep track of what you're doing there at the Discord channel, YouTube page, and I guess you're on all the social sites as well.
Yes.
All right. So I guess that brings us to the end of our show. Thanks us
thank
for
you so much
thank
for you.
Yeah, thank you for spending this time with
thanks
us. Really appreciate
on.
It. Yeah. So right. For viewers, if you have any questions or comments, please leave them below or get in touch with us on the social media platform of your choice. We're on them all. Don't forget, if you like the show, please give us a thumbs up, click subscribe, tap that bell icon for notifications. Thank you all again very much for joining us, and we'll see you again very soon. Ciao.